welcome to today's internet webcast on tools for evaluating and optimizing groundwater monitoring networks. The seminar is sponsored by EPA and by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. My name is Kathy Yeager, and I'm with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, just the Superfund program for short, and I'll be moderating today's session. We'll be getting started in a few moments, but while we wait for everyone to get on, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session, and we've also included pictures, short bio sketches, and links to email addresses for each of the presenters. So if you would like to follow up with some questions after the seminar, you'll be able to contact the presenters by their email addresses on that page. And by now, all of you should have clicked on the Go to Seminar icon on the front page and be on slide number one of the presentation, which is the title slide. The main page contains the slides, above which you'll find the navigation icons, and you can navigate forward and backward by using the orange buttons on the top of the screen. And as the presenters go through the slides, they'll be announcing the slide number to which they are moving. And as I said, you can advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the slide number on the left-hand frame. So moving to slide two, just a few brief housekeeping items before we get started. For those of you joining via the phone lines, which is actually not a very large number, we request that you put your phone on mute, which it sounds like most of you have already done. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, you can press star 6 and place your phone on mute. And to unmute your phone, you can press pound 6. But whatever you do, please don't put us on hold. Many organizations have lovely hold music or other advertisements that can be very disruptive to the seminar. As far as questions go, for the presenters, we'll have two question and answer sessions. You can submit questions one of two ways. At the top of your screen, you'll see a question icon where you can click on that and email questions. You'll type your question in and then you hit submit, and the questions will be presented to the moderator, to myself. And then I will read those questions during our question and answer session. Now, you also can ask questions orally during the Q&A sessions by unmuting your phone and asking the question that way. A couple other things. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. You could pass that information on to others that were not able to attend today but that you think may be interested in it. And associated with the links page, you'll see this either on the main page or at the very end, you don't have to do it right now, is a feedback form. And we ask that you consider filling out this online form. Now, this is our first internet seminar on this topic, and we would really appreciate your suggestions on how to improve it. I think we're ready to kick off the session, so moving on to slide three, I will briefly introduce the presenters. Again, as I said, my name is Kathy Yeager. I'm an environmental engineer with EPA's Superfund program. One of our other presenters is Dr. Mindy Vanderford, and she's a senior associate environmental scientist at GSI Environmental out of Houston, Texas. And today she's actually broadcasting live from Austin because she's been displaced as a result of Hurricane Ike. And Mindy works for the company that developed one of the programs we'll be talking about today. It's a free program, and their office put it together with funding from the Air Force. And you'll be hearing more about that program today. Our other speaker is Dave Becker, and Dave is a geologist with the Environmental Engineering and Geology Division at the Environmental and Munitions Center of Expertise of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Omaha, Nebraska. And Dave is a practitioner and user of these LTMO, long-term monitoring optimization, or LTMO techniques that you'll be hearing about. And as several of you may have heard, he's actually out on a site visit and meeting right now at an Army base in Wisconsin, getting ready to do one of these reviews. Moving on to slide 4, briefly some of the topics that we'll cover today. We're going to start out with the definition of long-term monitoring optimization, or LTMO. You'll hear us refer to this topic, LTMO, throughout the entire session, so I wanted to make sure everyone understood that acronym. And I'll talk about why EPA and the Corps are involved in this topic, the appropriate timing for conducting one of these LTMO evaluations, some of the data needs and available methods, regulatory and technical reviews. So if you're a regulator and your responsible party submits a report to change your monitoring network based on one of these optimization studies, we'll give you some tips on what to look for in reviewing those reports. We have time for just one case study example, and that's the Frontier Hard Chrome Superfund site. We'll talk about some of the obstacles to doing these evaluations, and then we have a link to additional resources. Moving on to slide 5, some of the motivation for LTMO. It's probably quite obvious to nearly everyone on the call. A lot of it comes down to money, and long-term monitoring is a growing, persistent, and a costly obligation for government agencies and private parties. And we've estimated that the federal government spends over $100 million each year just on monitoring groundwater. And that would mean typically over 100,000 per site. So we're up there, you know, over $100 million for the federal government. And we recognize that private parties are likely spending more. So the sheer magnitude of the cost of this effort of long-term monitoring is one of the main reasons that we're involved in this. A little bit more on the motivation. Many long-term monitoring networks have not been carefully evaluated since the remedy was implemented. And as many of you know, monitoring wells that were installed during the characterization phase are oftentimes automatically rolled into the long-term groundwater monitoring network. And as we know, conditions change over time. In the subsurface, contaminants migrate vertically, horizontally. Contaminants are moved via remediation. And that monitoring network needs to be reevaluated based on current conditions. These periodic evaluations are necessary and very much beneficial. On slide 7, this is a definition that we pulled together. It's a little bit wordy, but we thought it would be helpful to at least have a one-sentence definition so that we all get on the same page. And I'll read a portion of it here. LTMO is a formal review of the monitoring network using qualitative and quantitative tools in order to achieve an environmentally, economically, and fiscally sound and sustainable monitoring network. Now, I did leave a few words out there because it's quite wordy. But I think the important aspect of this definition is that we view this approach as having two pieces to it, the qualitative piece, which is more of the professional judgment piece, and then the quantitative piece, which is using some of the newer statistical and mathematical tools that we'll be talking about today to ensure that you have a monitoring network that is protective to human health and the environment, and then it's also efficient. Okay, moving on to slide 8. An overview of LTMO, a little bit more in the background here. By going through an LTMO evaluation, you can confirm that your monitoring program or your monitoring network matches your needs for monitoring. I think what's important to mention here is that we need to ask the questions about why are we sampling each well, what data do we need from that sampling event, and how will we use that data. And if you go through well by well across the site, asking those questions, it can help you pull together the objectives of your monitoring program, and then you can go back and evaluate whether the network that you have in place can meet those objectives. And some of the key things that we look at are spatially where your samples are collected and then how frequently you collect those samples. We'll also look at sampling and analytical methods as well as how the data is managed. Today we're going to focus more on the spatial sampling and the temporal or the frequency of the sampling. And as I had mentioned, there are two primary approaches, the qualitative and the quantitative, and we recommend combining the two, and you'll hear a lot more about that from the other presenters. Now, some of the benefits of LTMO on slide 9, it really can go either way. If you're conducting one of these evaluations, you want to make sure that you have the most appropriate monitoring network in place, given site conditions and management goals for the site. So that may mean that you can, after doing one of these reviews, that there are redundant wells, and you may be able to reduce wells or remove wells from the monitoring network, or you may be able to reduce the frequency of sampling those wells. However, oftentimes it goes the other way as well. We may identify areas of high uncertainty or new receptors in areas where we feel we need to sample more frequently. So it really goes both ways. And at most of the sites that we've looked at, we usually have both sets of recommendations, portions of the site that can be reduced and maybe a couple areas where we need to crank up the sampling. But by doing the analysis, it can, and you'll learn more about this from the other presenters, it can show you areas where the plume is moving or changing and just give you a better picture of what's happening in the subsurface. On slide 10, by going through this process, you pull all of the stakeholders together up front, and it helps you clarify those monitoring objectives that I had mentioned earlier. And that meeting and that discussion of the purpose of the monitoring we find is very valuable at most sites. And it provides the analysis can provide important data to support, a remedy evaluation that may be being conducted in parallel. And in the end, we hope that it provides a monitoring program that is better focused on supporting decisions. I'm sorry, I have to get a drink of water. Okay, I'm back. A monitoring network that is better focused on supporting decisions, that reduces data gaps, and hopefully is less costly and conserves resources, and that may be from labor, collecting samples, fuel, supplies, etc. Okay, moving on to slide 11. I already briefly mentioned this, but because it's an essential part of the training, I think it doesn't hurt to mention it a few times. The qualitative evaluation is typically based on professional judgment or intimate knowledge of the site, decision rules, or other heuristic methods. And oftentimes this is done by an experienced hydrogeologist or an engineer that's been working on the site for many years, or someone from the team pulled together to do the LTMO review. And then the quantitative evaluations are based on statistical, mathematical, or modeling, or empirical evidence. Slide 12. I'm going to briefly mention some of the methods that are available right now for use. Either they're in the public domain or they are with private consulting firms. The first three here, the Parsons three-tiered approach, the monitoring and remediation optimization software, or MAROS, and the geostatistical temporal spatial, or GTS, optimization algorithm, are all available for free in the public domain. Most of them were developed based on funding from the Air Force, a significant amount of investment made by the Air Force on this topic. And we'll have links where you can access more information on these methods. The MAROS method and the GTS methods are more software-based, where they're packaged programs, whereas the Parsons approach is more of a consulting approach, but it has been very well documented in the literature and kind of walks you through the process, but you have to go outside to do some of these statistics. And then there are some newer methods that use more advanced techniques, using mathematical optimization. And you'll hear about those in a bit. But those are not, as of now, in the public domain. So when would you apply or conduct a long-term monitoring optimization? When is the appropriate timing? You'll see the horizontal arrow here, which generally represents the progression of cleanup activities at a site from characterization on the left to remedy selection, construction, and initial post-construction monitoring, and then long-term monitoring. Generally, the LTMO reviews that we're talking about would take place in that long-term monitoring phase. So once most of the disturbance to the subsurface has taken place through the construction of the remedy or remedies or any removal actions, and you are at a point now where you're at relatively steady state conditions and you have a data set to work with. It doesn't mean that you can't do it earlier in the process, but mostly we're focusing on the post-construction side. Slide 15, some of the candidates for long-term monitoring optimization. So, in other words, does it make sense to do it at your site? Some of the rules of thumb are if your source is identified, if the plume boundaries, both vertically and horizontally, have been delineated, and if you have your data in a database with well coordinates and groundwater parameters in one place. That typically needs to happen either as part of the review or before the review. And oftentimes we know that data is either in hard copy, in reports on people's desks, or maybe one firm has data from 5 years ago and there's a new firm that has recent data, or multiple parties and it's scattered around. So you really need to pull it together as one of the first steps. And you also need to establish those monitoring objectives. But again, that can be done as part of the process. Now, another piece here is I believe that LTMO can be useful in preparation for upcoming five-year reviews. By going through this analysis and scrutinizing trends in data over time, getting a better understanding of what's happening in the subsurface, either in individual wells or plume-wide, that information can really feed into a five-year review, and we've done that at several sites now where the analysis was used to feed into writing the five-year review. Now, again, it doesn't answer all of the questions of the five-year review, but the shedding light on what's happening in the subsurface is the piece that it does cover. We know that there's a lot of work, the second bullet here, specifically looking at optimizing individual remedies. But if you can combine the monitoring optimization with looking at specifically a remedy optimization, it can be a very powerful and robust combined evaluation. And also prior to property transfer, by looking at streamlining your monitoring network, identifying which wells are very important to keep in the monitoring network for the long term, which wells could be eliminated. It can help facilitate that property transfer and redevelopment and make sure that, for example, a parking lot or a building doesn't get placed over some wells that you'd need for long-term monitoring. Now, cost, just generally to give you an idea of what we're talking about. For smaller sites, we generally have stakeholder agreement, uncomplicated hydrogeology and constituents on the order of $10,000 to $15,000 as a ballpark. And that goes up as your site gets larger. You have many more monitoring wells. You have multiple constituents. You have multiple aquifer units and other complications in the hydrogeology. It can go well over $30,000. Moving on to slide 18, I said I would mention why EPA and the Army Corps are sponsoring this and what our roles are. We have been involved in training on this topic. As I mentioned, this is our first internet seminar, but we have been doing in-person training now for over 4 years. And our goal with that was to try to reach out to states and EPA regulators. It was also open to contractors as well, to get the word out about these tools and where you can go for more information and some of the benefits and things to look out for. So we've been doing that for a number of years. We've hit all regions, and we're sort of at the point of wrapping that up. We're likely to do one more in Denver in the wintertime. We're involved in other technology transfer aspects as well. We've prepared a document called the Roadmap to Long-Term Monitoring Optimization with the Army Corps. I'll mention more about that in a second. And we've also put together several websites you'll see at the bottom of this slide, cluewin.org/optimization. By clicking on that website and navigating through to the LTMO section, you'll find everything that EPA has done related to this topic, case studies, various reports, etc. there. And then on the frtr.gov/optimization website, this is a website for federal agencies to post information related to optimization, and there is a link to LTMO. You have to navigate specifically to LTMO. And there are other case studies and guidance documents from other federal agencies. There is some research and development ongoing to make improvements to some of the software that's out there through various programs, and we're tied into those either directly or loosely. And then we've also pooled our resources with other federal agencies and a state organization to provide technical support on the use of MAROS, and we just call it the MAROS hotline. It's more like the Mindy Vanderford hotline. We've set aside some funding so that Mindy is available to answer your questions on the use of MAROS. And specifically for EPA, we've also set funding aside for technical support to RPMs who may want to use MAROS at their site, or they want some assistance because the PRP is using MAROS at their site. On slide 19, this is the 7 steps to LTMO. This is sort of the essence of that roadmap that I mentioned that we put out in 2005. And the training today is based on this roadmap. And as you go through the training, you'll see these various topics covered. But by putting out the roadmap, we wanted to explain sort of in plain language what these techniques can do, what you need to look out for, when it would be appropriate to do one of these evaluations, where you can go for more information. A lot of the stuff we're covering today, it's in that roadmap, but we expand on it a little bit more in the training, especially in the in-person training. This is just 2 hours, so there's only so much we can cover. The in-person training is 8 hours and then 4 hours of training with the MAROS software. Okay, now on to the next topic. I'm going to turn it over to Mindy Vanderford for LTMO data needs.
Hey, hello everybody. Good afternoon on the East Coast. Good morning on the West Coast. This is Mindy Vanderford broadcasting live from Austin, Texas, Hurricane Refugee Radio, hoping you're all blown away by LTMO today. I'm going to start talking about the data you need to collect before you start your optimization. Moving on to slide 22, for the past several years, we've been doing long-term monitoring optimization at several sites, and we've identified 5 basic categories of data or information that you need to support these evaluations. The first is kind of an interesting thing that we found. You need monitoring objectives, remedial action objectives, and a good sense of why you're going out and collecting data and who you're collecting it for. The second general area of data that you need is the site conceptual model, things like the hydrogeology, the groundwater flow direction, the seepage velocity, porosity, source areas, and so forth. The third category I'm going to talk about are temporal data, data that are true only over a certain time frame, and you collect them up and line them up, and it helps define what's going on at the site. One of the unique things about LTMO is it's very reliant on high-quality spatial data, and I find that a lot of site managers aren't as accustomed to collecting and storing and transmitting spatial data as we might hope. And the fifth major category of information you need is your budget. How much are you spending at the site? How much are you spending for each activity? And where can you find efficiencies in this budget? And how are you going to improve the overall management of your budget? Moving on to slide number 23. There are two unique factors in LTMO that are somewhat different from routine site management. First, by the time you get to long-term monitoring optimization, the quantity and diversity of data on your site are usually very high, stored in multiple locations. You may have a database that covers from 2002 to 2008, and all the data before that are in boxes. The data from the 80s are stored in some other consultants or out in a warehouse. And you have a lot of different kinds of data. You have pump test data collected by one set of consultants and grain size information collected from another, and it's just hard to put it all together, and maybe no one sat down and put it together. The second major feature of LTMO is that it is more dependent on statistics and particularly geostatistics than other types of site work. And this can be kind of a new area that site managers are exploring and a little bit challenging. But, after a while, it becomes very enjoyable. You know, trust me on that one. Slide number 24. So I like to get started by focusing people on what the activity of sampling is all about. Usually when you're at a site and you've been there for a long time, you get into a comfortable routine, and perhaps you haven't engaged with the material and the whole point of doing it for quite a while. The substance of sampling is that you have a hypothesis, an idea, or an objective that you want to find information out about. And then you take a sample, you review the sample results, you make a decision, that leads to an action, or sometimes an inaction, and that results in a change in how you view the site. And so you revise your hypothesis, you go out, you take another sample, you review it, and you keep refining what you think over time. Now, the sampling for groundwater monitoring, at the beginning, when you're doing site characterization, site investigation, the sampling cycle is fueled by uncertainty. You're uncertain about different aspects of the site, and it's also fueled by the rate of decision-making that you have to accomplish. If you have to make a lot of decisions, like on remedial processes and institutional controls, you need a lot more data a lot more quickly. After a while, when you've reduced this uncertainty substantially and you don't have to make a lot of decisions rapidly, you can reduce your sampling effort and kind of get off this cycle, this treadmill. Okay, slide number 25. I'm going to talk about why monitoring objectives are important. Monitoring objectives are the first step in the cycle. You know, why are you going out to sample? What do you need to know? What do you want to know? When do you need to know it? And what are you trying to prove? What are you trying to demonstrate with the data you collect? Now, a lot of times this is not written down anywhere. This is not in a ROD. You can't find it in a corrective measure study. It's not in a remedial investigation. So you need to sit down and decide why you're going out and sampling and what it's going to support. Slide number 26. The second part of monitoring objectives is understanding what your user group is or your stakeholder group. Who else needs to know this information? When do they need to know it? What form do they need to receive the information in? Sampling, the whole monitoring program is in one way a scientific and quantitative approach, and in the other it's a social and policy approach. And you need to understand aspects of both sides in order to develop the most efficient system to support your site management. Slide number 27. So monitoring objectives. And each well should serve at least one monitoring objective in your network. For example, if you need to know what the concentration in the source area is, you want to identify your source area wells. Do you need 7 wells to define the source area? Do you need 10? Or do you need 1? So each time you come up with a monitoring objective, you can determine which wells satisfy that objective and how many of them you need. This is also true for things like remedial effectiveness. How are you going to judge the efficacy of your remedy? You know, do you need 50 wells or do you need 12? Receptors. Do you need a well at each receptor? Do you need 3 wells? This is why monitoring objectives are extremely important. In slide number 28, I list several very popular monitoring objectives. Again, evaluating remedy efficacy, evaluating source depletion, delineation of the plume. Delineation is one of the main reasons we install wells. Evaluating contaminant migration, background concentrations. Meta objectives, there are other objectives that may tie in, such as building trust between stakeholders. For example, if you have an important person or a particularly neurotic property owner next door, it may be good to keep a well in near their property in order to satisfy their needs. I mean, it's not necessarily a scientific objective, but it is a property management and property operation and maintenance objective. You can have objectives that include supporting, collecting data to support groundwater models, property redevelopment, pending litigation, wells that you may sample in cases of extreme weather events. Actually, this may be a theme throughout some of this talk today. But anyway, writing down these monitoring objectives and making sure that all the stakeholders understand what the objectives of your monitoring network are can be a really simple way to get started on optimizing and creating the most efficient network possible. In slide number 29, we show an important aspect to monitoring objectives, and that is being able to define what your decision points or trigger points for actions are. For example, if you need to collect data in order to optimize your remedy, you may want to identify which data points provide the best information for that. And say a plume shrinks back beyond a certain point, you may want to reduce your pumping. So you need to collect data to demonstrate that your plume is shrinking so that you can reduce your pumping. On the other hand, you need to know what concentrations at what points in down gradient may trigger installation of a contingent remedy or an additional remedy. So if your plume grows, you have to add a new remedy, and you need to know what triggers that action. Also, expanding your institutional controls. So identifying what's going to make you get up out of your chair and actually do something is important. And then you collect data to support that decision. Slide number 30. What are your metrics of success? How will you know when you've achieved the next level in your path towards site closure? Do you need to demonstrate plume stability? What type of data do you need to collect to demonstrate plume stability? Is your remedy reducing total dissolved mass in the plume? What type of data and what locations do you need to show that total mass is being reduced? Is your remedy protective? Does it delineate? These are the kind of things you want to think about when you're designing your monitoring network. Slide number 31, this is a list of the things that are common in a conceptual site model, the things that I want to see when I get started on doing an LTMO. I want a good explanation of where the sources are. I want to know where the tail is. I want to know where the plume ends. I want to know what analytes have been evaluated and whether or not you have a full list. For example, if you're looking at some chlorinated solvents, and there were solvent stabilizers in the solvents when they were used, have you looked at the location and the distribution of solvent stabilizers in the plume as well? You add a COC later on and you don't have as much data, so it can be hard to interpret. I need to know the geology, hydrogeology of the site, groundwater flow direction, does it change over time? I need to know where the potential receptors are and what the priority receptors are. It's good to know the regulatory framework. For some sites, you have regional EPA oversight, state oversight, municipal oversight. There may be military involved. You need to know who the stakeholders are and what each of them require from your site. And one of the most important categories of information I need is what is the future property development going to be? Where are we going? Is this site going to continue as a commercial industrial site? Is it in an urban area scheduled to become residential housing? These are important things for designing an efficient network to support the redevelopment, to support the next step in property development. Slide number 32, the data conceptual model. It's important for everyone to look back and see how their data are managed. I know it's hard when for geologists who started in the 1980s, and it was just wonderful to get three data points from a site, and you can put that three data points in a report. Well, after 25 years, we have 300,000 data points. How are those being managed? Can you develop significant cost savings from improving your management strategy? The cartoon on slide 32 shows basically how are you collecting the samples. You need to keep track of whether it's low flow or purge. How is the laboratory analyzing the samples? Are the data comparable between the 1980s and now? How are the data put into a database? How are they managed in a group? Are they in boxes, or are they in Excel tables? Are they in a relational SQL Server database? And the next step is, how do you traditionally analyze the data? Which statistics do you use? How do you visualize this data? How does your data management system support data visualization? And finally, how does your data management system support communication to your site stakeholders? So it's good to have an idea of this pipeline of information that's running from your site. In slide number 33, I discussed temporal data. And temporal data is what we normally think of when we're looking at sampling data. It's the analytes, and the dates that you sampled the wells and which locations you sampled. In deciding whether or not you have enough data to do a long-term monitoring optimization, we suggest that you need at least 4 to 8 sampling events, data from 4 to 8 sampling events, in order to perform rudimentary statistics on it, and to get an idea of how things are moving. Sampling intervals. I know a lot of times they're very irregular, but sampling intervals should be related to the rate of concentration change and, to a certain extent, the groundwater flow velocity. I know that sometimes you go out and you look at data and, you know, there are quarterly samples for 2 years, and then you change consultants and there are 2 years where you've not collected any data, and then you do it semi-annually for 1 year and then annually. It can be very confusing, but it's important to have 4 to 8 sample events in your database. And I often suggest that you collect data for 2 years after installation of your major remedy, after installation of your pumping system, your cap, your soil vapor extraction system. And it's good to have a little bit of data before and a little bit of data after in order to evaluate what's going on at the site. Slide number 34. These are the characteristics of a high-quality analytical database. I want to see consistent constituent names and cast numbers because in order to do this analysis quickly, you have to pull the data out. And if you have various spellings or mistakes in your cast number, it can cost you a day or two going back and trying to fix your database. So it's one of my personal pet peeves. It's good to have a full list of constituents. I know I've looked at sites where one consultant had the TCE data and another consultant had the vinyl chloride data, and I couldn't get them all together in the same place. You want analytical results, detection limits. Detection limits are like socks in the dryer. They disappear over time. Get a report and none of the detection limits are listed. So it's good to put those when you have them in your database. Consistent well names. Over time, I know depending on the owner of the property or the sampling team, well names can change. So it's good to develop a consistent set of names for your wells. data flags are important, sample dates, and also the analytical method. Listing the analytical method can really help you decide whether two data sets are comparable. And if you see a problem in your data, sometimes if you look back and the sampling method or the analytical method has changed, that'll explain why you see sudden jumps. In any case, developing a high-quality analytical database should be everyone's responsibility. I know sometimes the responsibility for database management is left to temporary help or clerical help, but really everyone in the management chain needs to review the quality of the database and the quality of data that are managed there. In slide number 35, it's a picture of what a database looks like. It's not a series of Excel tables. It's not a series of PDFs from reports. You see, you have the well name, the location coordinates, which I'll talk about a little more later, and a way of identifying which samples are actually non-detects. You can put a zero in a column and a one to identify detects from non-detects. You can put flags like U's and N's, or you can put null cells for non-detect data in order to go back in and substitute in the detection limit or half the detection limit. And this makes automation of your analysis a lot easier. Okay, slide number 36. The spatial database is another really important and somewhat unique to LTMO. Spatial databases have location coordinates, construction details, screened intervals, construction dates, which aquifer unit or which geological formation it's screened in, the elevation. And also, I like to add another field that describes the function of the well. For example, if it is a source well, I write source well. If it's a point of exposure or a delineation well, I write delineation well in. That way you can pull out the wells that are serving each one of your monitoring objectives. It's a way of organizing your network spatially. So slide number 37. Specifically, spatial data include geographic coordinates not just for your sampling locations, but for your receptors, your property boundaries, also your remedy systems, and other aspects. Spatial data is best kept in some sort of GIS, or Geographic Information System computer file, in shape files or DXF files for AutoCAD, and these should be able to be shared among stakeholders. It's important to identify your source areas or your areas of peak concentrations in your spatial database as well. Slide number 38. Delineation of the plume or historic plume contours can be important. These don't necessarily have to be in electronic format. They can be in the form of scanned copies of old reports. But it's good to have them on hand to see how the interpretation of the plume has changed over time as more data is collected. Also, identification of major discontinuities or heterogeneities in the subsurface, such as channels or clay lenses, it can really help explain what's going on. And this is also part of the site conceptual model. Also, identification of surface water areas where groundwater may be discharging, that can be very helpful because it may change how you sample the site. Slide number 39, the all-important budget. Before you get started on LTMO, you need to look at the cost of doing the optimization versus the savings you expect. And the cost of the monitoring program not only includes the lab costs, the mobilization costs, but also the data management and reporting. I know that the Air Force has calculated somewhere between $700 and $750 per sample. And that includes not just the laboratory, but the management of the data after it is collected. On the other hand, the benefits of LTMO are not just cutting back on your monitoring network or cutting back on your frequency, reducing overall monitoring costs, but also speeding your property toward redevelopment, getting toward closure faster. Developing consensus between your stakeholders. These can be extremely powerful efficiencies that are often not recognized before an LTMO occurs. And also support for remedial process decisions, remedial process optimizations. If you can collect better data to cut back on your pumping rate or cut back on your GAC redevelopment, that can be really important and motivation as well. Slide number 40. I'm going to turn this over to Dave Becker, my good friend now, and he's going to talk to you about qualitative approaches to data analysis.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mindy. And yes, now just to give everybody kind of a sense for where we are in the process, Mindy's just gone through, the data that are required to support long-term monitoring optimization. And now we're going to start a discussion about the different approaches to actually conducting the LTMO. And I'm going to start with the qualitative approach that Kathy had mentioned earlier. And so, again, we're on slide 40, moving on to slide 41. Before we jump into some of the considerations for qualitative analysis, just wanted to emphasize some things and sort of follow up on some things that Mindy had brought up about the data necessary for this. And one of the keys, in my opinion, is understanding data comparability over time. Concentration data comparability is important. And one of the reasons it's important is that for qualitative or for quantitative analysis, really what we're often doing is comparing recent sampling results to what's happened in the past. And it's that relative difference and change in concentration that we're really kind of interested in. So we have to understand how other things besides the environmental conditions might have been changing some of the concentration numbers that we've been seeing. So we look at the data comparability both in time and in space, because sometimes there's some issues, as I'll discuss, across the site. One of the big things, and Mindy's already alluded to this, is the impact of actually conducting some type of cleanup, some corrective action or remedial action. And there's often changes that occur with that. So we have to know when those occurred in the past and if there's been any shift in the concentrations on the site related to that, and factor that into what time window we might want to look at for our more recent data to compare to. Another aspect we might want to look at that affects comparability, maybe there's been a significant weather event or a climatic change, a prolonged drought or an extremely wet year, a hurricane blowing through, as happened to Mindy. Those kind of things, we have to recognize perhaps any signature in the concentration data as a result of those things. And I always give an example of one site in Southern California that I consulted on where they had a prolonged 4 or 5 year drought, and during that time concentrations changed significantly. A number of wells went dry, and then when El Nino hit and they actually got rain again, some of the wells had water level jumps of 100 feet or more, and when the rains came and the wells all had water in them, again, the concentration distribution was much different than what happened before the drought. So knowing that that was related to the drought, is something that we would consider in evaluating concentration data collected going forward. And so that's something we want to verify. And then there are other things that we do, just as a matter of course, improving technology in that, we change our sampling method. That may have some shift, may cause some shift in the concentrations we've observed. Perhaps we've changed well construction over time, or there may be wells on site that have a different construction that may lead to some differences spatially in concentrations that we have observed, particularly, say, in metals concentrations or whatever. And then lastly, there may be changes in our analytical methods, and that related aspects, including dilutions that were necessary or changes in the detection limits over time. And I want to emphasize that it's good to try and track those detection limits over time. Don't let them be socks lost in the dryer, as Mindy said. Let's move now to slide 42. Those considerations for the data comparability factor into both qualitative and quantitative, but we're going to talk more about the qualitative here, and I'll try to emphasize how that fits in. The two key aspects for qualitative analysis really have to do with evaluating the temporal changes and the spatial distribution of wells. The temporal variability, we look at the nature of the concentration trends, increasing, decreasing, and how variable the results are from sampling event to sampling event. Generally speaking, wells with increasing concentration trends near the edges of the plume usually are triggers for more intense sampling, more frequent samples. Wells that have very noisy data that are difficult to predict from sample event to sample event also may require more intense sampling, more frequent sampling. Conversely, decreasing concentrations near the edges of the plume or other things that are typically associated with, you know, a successful cleanup, those, you know, are going to be circumstances where we may be able to feel comfortable in cutting back the level of intensity. Regarding the spatial distribution of the monitoring wells, again, the real key here is the proximity of wells to one another. Generally speaking, if you have a number of wells in close proximity to each other relative to the scope of the problem, the more likelihood you have of some of those wells being redundant, the duplicating effort and duplicating information, I should say. And so some of those wells may be candidates for removal from the program. Whereas there may be other parts of the site where you have large distances between wells where you're really not sure what's going on in the plume. So you have a high degree of uncertainty in the contours you draw or whatever, the decisions you might make about the behavior of the plume there. Those are areas where we're really going to look to perhaps add some wells to answer those questions. So those are the two primary qualitative considerations. And I'm going to talk about several other major considerations on the subsequent slide. They're listed there under the third bullet. So let's move to slide 43. The first of these other considerations I want to talk about is the impact of the hydrogeology. And as a geologist, I always consider this fairly important. But certainly, we look at what the geology may allow in terms of the transport of contaminants in the groundwater. And so we're going to focus on those pathways that have a higher permeability, a higher rate of transport for groundwater and therefore contaminant. So that's going to be the focus for our well locations and maybe those zones where we're going to want to take more frequent samples because we expect changes to occur more frequently. And this is particularly true near the down gradient or leading edges of the plume. Wells, though, on the sides of the plume, cross gradient from the plume, or certainly up gradient, we don't anticipate, you know, even in fairly high permeability materials, we don't anticipate as rapid potential changes. And so, again, our monitoring intensity may be somewhat less there. However, we have to consider the potential for variable flow directions over time, particularly in areas subjected to seasonal pumping for irrigation or water supply or whatever. You know, we have to make sure that our monitoring network accounts for those differences in flow direction. And then we can't forget about the third dimension. A lot of times people tend to look at maps and forget that there's a depth to the plume. And so we have to make sure that we have adequate monitoring to assess vertical changes in the plume, and that may be due to changes in piezometric surface or drought or whatever, or just systematic changes in the nature of the plume over time. Let's move now to slide 44. Another important aspect that is somewhat related to the one we just talked about, but that is what is the contaminant likely to do? We talked previously about what groundwater is doing. Well, what's the contaminant likely to do? Obviously, the greater the groundwater velocities, the more frequent the sampling, as I mentioned, we probably want to look at for the leading edge of the plume, but we have to factor in the contaminant partitioning behavior and retardation factors for those contaminants as well. And so the bottom line is that the faster we expect the contaminant itself to be migrating based on its properties in groundwater flow, the more intense their monitoring. And I would like to point out that at most sites, groundwater and the contaminant usually aren't moving all that fast. We typically measure groundwater and contaminant migration velocities on the order of tens to several hundred feet per year at most sites. And so, you know, depending on where the site is and the scope of the problem, you know, that really doesn't mean that things are going to change all that rapidly in most cases. So let's move now to slide 45. Mindy's already made a very good case for identifying and writing down monitoring objectives, and I just want to kind of expand a little bit on the qualitative evaluation of the monitoring program in light of the objectives. And typically we have monitoring objectives to evaluate the stability and movement of the plume. So we're looking at the plume boundary defined by whatever concentration level is of regulatory or risk interest. And so we're going to have wells inside and outside that boundary to define that contour line. We're also often interested in what the concentrations are doing along the interior of the plume, usually along the axis, as an indication of the success of whatever cleanup activity that we've got. And so it's really an indication of remedy performance. So we look at what wells we've got to achieve these two primary objectives, perhaps in conjunction with background determination, things like that. But wells that don't contribute to these objectives are probably candidates for exclusion from the monitoring program. And where we have questions about our ability to achieve these objectives, those are areas where we would perhaps need to consider additional wells. And just a word here about the background monitoring is that a lot of times, once we've gone through the site characterization process, we've got background concentrations and conditions fairly well documented. And so by the time we get to the long-term monitoring phase of the project, background concentrations aren't as much of an interest anymore, and background wells don't need to be sampled typically all that often, if at all. So just kind of an observation. Slide 46 now. Another consideration is the actual risk for a real exposure to humans or ecological receptors. Generally speaking, the more likely or the more imminent an exposure on the part of receptors, the more intense the monitoring program should be. On the other hand, if the site is relatively remote and there's really not any current receptors, our level of effort may be able to be reduced. And that's really looking at what the current site use is. But we can't lose sight of what the site vicinity may become in the future, and so we have to look at the future land use. For example, we may want to qualitatively adjust our monitoring if it becomes apparent that residential use is likely for what was an undeveloped area or a formerly industrial area. We may want to maintain a certain sample network, even if we're not using some of the wells for sampling now. We may want to preserve them in anticipation of future land use changes. We may have to increase the sample frequency on some wells, even the ones that we continue to sample, just because the land use is changing and you have different exposure pathways for people. And a good example of that might be where residential use is likely and vapor intrusion may become an issue for people who build above a plume. The other aspect of future land use is what impact are the future redevelopment going to have on your monitoring network? Because a lot of times wells get removed by bulldozer as a result of these things. And I know with the case study we'll talk about that happened there. So something to kind of keep in mind and make sure you coordinate on. Let's move to slide 47. The last thing I wanted to talk about in terms of an additional major consideration is the impact of cleanup actions or contingent actions. And as Mindy already said, that a lot of times you have, disruption in the contaminant concentration trend as a result of some type of construction or cleanup activities. That can be anything from capping to the initiation of pump and treat. And so it's good to kind of let that settle out before you start sampling. And you have to think about qualitatively what impacts those activities would have. But another way to look at it is if you've got decisions that hinge on your monitoring data, and one of those decisions happens to be the implementation of a contingent remedial or corrective action, then you have to consider the time frame that you have to implement that contingent action to prevent an exposure. The more time that you have before a real risk appears, the less frequent you have to sample. if you've got little time to react, though, then you should probably be sampling more frequently so that you're in a better position to implement in a timely way. And, you know, it obviously depends on how long it's going to take to implement that corrective action or remedial action. So if it's a long weed item that you need or it takes a while to construct and implement, then obviously that would factor into. Let's move to slide 48. I've got a slide here, just a grab bag of some other things that might be an issue or a consideration for a qualitative review and are often best addressed through a qualitative review. The first one is what the stakeholders might have in the way of concerns. A lot of times these are difficult to quantify and really result in making some decisions about retaining specific wells or whatever to allay fears or concerns. There may be regulatory requirements too that that have to be met. Quantitative methods, you know, may not really be able to factor in. Another aspect that relates to how frequently you might want to sample is just how often does anybody even look at the data? If the project team only evaluates the data and assesses its impact on decisions at the site once a year, is quarterly sampling really gaining you a whole lot? You know, you would like to think that people look at the data as it comes in, but that's not always the case. Sampling with a frequency that's comparable to the time period at which people are evaluating the results probably makes sense. From a spatial monitoring network optimization point of view, some of the things that go into deciding whether or not to remove or retain wells in the network, wells that are considered compliance points or important sentinel wells for an exposure point, those are obviously going to be preserved in the network. You probably want to retain wells for perhaps infrequent sampling for background definition, particularly if you've got other plumes in the area from other sources. You may want to give preference to wells that are reliable and propose for removal where you have redundancy. Those wells that have some questions about their integrity due to poor construction, or perhaps that they periodically go dry during periods of low water tables or whatever. Those poor performers would be good candidates for removal. On the other hand, there may be wells that have a long sampling history that we're going to give preference to because they've got that long history so that we have a continuity in data in certain locations. And then lastly, we again are going to be looking where we've got data gaps as areas where we'd want to add some wells. Let's move now to slide 49. As Kathy mentioned, we really do recommend combining the qualitative and quantitative approaches that we're talking about here today. The benefit of doing a qualitative analysis, a quantitative analysis that Mindy will talk about, is that it's repeatable. It's got a clear logic that's transparent. That's a good thing, but it can't consider some of those factors that we just talked about. So qualitative analysis can consider some of these fuzzy factors better than the quantitative. But the unfortunate part about the qualitative analysis is that it's somewhat subjective depending on, as Kathy said, the professional judgment, the knowledge and experience of the person conducting the analysis. So combining the two builds on the strength of both and reduces the vulnerabilities due to the weaknesses of them. So the quantitative techniques that many will talk about really need to have some type of reality check, and that's usually done qualitatively, such that you consider those things that we just talked about, the unusual data, the outliers, the data comparability issues, the site hydrogeologic conditions, particularly the high permeability pathways or the variable flow directions, considering the well construction issues and the screen intervals on different depths or different wells, the stakeholder concerns and the land use changes that are imminent. And all these things are going to factor in as part of that combining the qualitative with the quantitative, such that the combination would perhaps give some preference to the qualitative analysis because they're able to account for these fuzzy things. Let's move now to slide 50. There's one other area where qualitative input's important, and it's really in doing some of the quantitative analysis, because some of the quantitative tools require input for and selection of different parameters, and they may be based on assumptions that need to be verified or are valid for a particular site. And so it's really for the qualitative analysis to provide input here. For example, there may be parameter settings in the quantitative optimization software that we have to determine somewhat qualitatively based on what I just talked about. A good example of that is what time period to look at in the past for the appropriate trends to compare more recent sampling results to. It's that selection of that window for the trend analysis that can be very important and is often adjusted qualitatively. Morrow's, for example, is a qualitative software tool, has different parameters of interest that you have to set thresholds for that trigger different recommendations. And you have to pick those, and then a lot of times that's done qualitatively. And that requires some consensus on the part of the project team and the stakeholders in a lot of cases. And even if consensus on selecting those parameters can't be reached, sometimes you can do sort of a sensitivity analysis. How dependent are the recommendations to the selection of some of these parameters? If a wide range of parameter selection doesn't really alter the fundamental recommendation from the quantitative tool, then maybe it's not worth arguing about. So these tools can help you come up with these qualitative selections a little bit. Moving on to slide 51, I'm going to turn it back over to Mindy.
Thanks, Dave. I'm going to talk about quantitative methods for evaluating long-term monitoring optimization. If we move on to slide number 52, like Kathy said earlier, a quantitative evaluation is one that is based on statistics, mathematics, modeling, or empirical evidence. We define an optimized system as one that where we have traded minor information losses for major gains in resources and savings and efficiency. So you'll see, as a common thread through all of these quantitative analyses, we're gauging how much information we have, how much information we may lose by taking out a well or reducing a frequency. So you'll see that kind of trade-off. The overall objective of a quantitative evaluation is to try to remove temporal and spatial redundancy in practical, statistically defensible ways. Ways that you can set out in front of your regulators and your stakeholders and identify, what data you're using to reduce your network. The good thing about a quantitative evaluation as opposed to a qualitative one is you step outside of your preconceptions. It's an objective way of looking at your data, and a lot of times it's helpful to have an outside person do this so that they aren't, they aren't stuck in the same preconceptions. Slide number 53. There are a series of steps or methods that are common to most LTMO analyses. I know there are several LTMO methods out there. Parsons three-tiered, Morrow's is just one of them, GTS. I'm not trying to sell any one method. I'm trying to talk about different steps that are common to almost all methods. The first step is a statistical summary of the data, and that's why it's good to have your data in a database so you can do your statistics easily. Trend analysis is very common to almost all methods, and I'll talk about that for a little bit. Then the spatial analysis is the thing that's unique and important to LTMO. Under a spatial analysis, you want to try to remove redundant wells and add wells or sampling locations in areas where you have higher uncertainty. So the spatial analysis generally focuses on quantifying your uncertainty between individual well locations. The fourth analysis that's common is temporal analysis, determining what the optimal sampling frequency is. In slide number 54, a little more explanation. Statistical trend analysis can be done on a number of different metrics. They can be done on concentrations at individual wells. They can even be done on potentiometric surfaces. You can also do statistical trend analysis on a plume-wide level. What is the total dissolved mass in the plume? Is it increasing over time? Is it decreasing over time? Applying statistical trend analysis to different metrics can be a very powerful way to go. Statistical significance testing, is this concentration statistically above or below our regulatory screening level? What quantifying your confidence in whatever you're trying to decide, that's an important aspect of statistical significance testing. Interpolation and geostatistics are also used frequently in LTMO analyses. These are ways of quantifying uncertainty between points. True mathematical optimization. I know we use the word optimization a lot in this talk, and that's kind of a small O optimization. Big O optimization is a mathematical discipline that came out of electrical engineering that's used to optimize different systems. And then groundwater flow models. Using groundwater flow models that may have been developed for other things to look at your groundwater monitoring network can be extremely powerful. Each of these methods is kind of, as I go down the list, is going up in the amount of expertise needed to do it, the amount of information needed to do it, and probably the cost of doing it. Looking at statistics, almost anyone can do it. You can use software or you can develop your own. But by the time you get to mathematical optimization and groundwater flow modeling, you really need a significant amount of specialized expertise for those methods. Slide number 55. I'm going to talk about basic statistics for a minute. You want to examine the summary statistics for the concentrations in your data. Looking at detection rates at certain wells, exceedances of regulatory screening levels, identifying outliers and upper confidence and lower confidence level. Outliers can be extremely destructive to a statistical analysis, and that's one of the things where a good data review will help you get rid of outliers. I also use the ProUCL software sponsored by the EPA to identify outliers. It's a very powerful tool. Looking at cumulative distribution functions, when do I reach the 80% of the total mass that I expect in the plume? Developing concentration maps. These are a little bit different from plume maps. We can identify well medians, well maxima, and dot maps, which are the average an average concentration at a location normalized by the screening level. That kind of gives you an alarm level of wells. Identifying hotspots on a map, that can be extremely helpful as well. And you don't necessarily need specialized tools to do this type of data exploration. Slide number 56. Simple statistics can be used to help prioritize constituents. A lot of times LTMO methods can only look at one constituent at a time. I know that's true in MAROS and in GTS and in other softwares. In this case, this is an example of a report printout from MAROS where we have commingled plumes and we're trying to prioritize which constituent is the highest priority. Under toxicity, you can see that we've developed a representative concentration, kind of an average concentration for the whole site, identified the screening level, and what percentage the average concentration is above this regulatory screening level. For prevalence, we look at the number of wells that exceed the screening level, and the number of detections. So these are real simple statistical tools that can help you identify which COCs are your priorities. If you focus on your priority COCs, you can also eliminate constituents from your analytical program that don't really contribute to you making site decisions. And identifying these priority constituents is a good first step in making your monitoring and your analysis more efficient. Slide number 57. Statistical trend analysis. I'm sure all of you have heard of the Mann-Kendall test statistic. It's loved and hated across the country. The Mann-Kendall approach basically relies on a series of sampling events. You need at least four to come up to do the statistic. The good thing about the Mann-Kendall approach is it's a non-parametric approach, which means that it doesn't rely on the fact that the data are in a specific distribution, like a normal distribution or a log normal distribution. And it also doesn't rely on the sample events being at equal intervals. Like I said earlier, sometimes you go out and you sample a well four times in 1 year and then not at all for 2 years. The Mann-Kendall statistic doesn't really, it doesn't rely on you having even sampling intervals. The foundation of the Mann-Kendall test is comparing one event to each event in the sequence. So you compare the first event to the second, the first to the third, the first to the fourth. If you have an increase in the concentration, it's plus one. If you have a decrease, it's minus one. You go through iteratively, and you end up with something called an S statistic. The S statistic is just one of the individual statistics that goes into the analysis. In slide number 58, we also look at the confidence factor. The Mann-Kendall approach has a hypothesis testing step, and what happens is you look up the probability of accepting the null hypothesis, which is there is no trend, for a certain number of samples and a certain S statistic, and you get a P. We define the confidence factor as 1 minus P. And if you have confidence of 95% or greater, that means you have 95% confidence in rejecting the null hypothesis, 95% confidence that you do have a trend. And that's a strong trend. 90% confidence correlates with, you know, a moderate trend. Choosing 90 or 95 as your cutoff is one of the qualitative parts of this quantitative approach. Different people may choose 85% or better as indicating a true trend. The other test statistic in this approach is the coefficient of variation. And I encourage everyone to look at the coefficient of variation in your data set. It's one of the things that helps the data tell a story about a site. If you have a lot of variance in the data, you know that there may be hydrogeologic conditions that cause variation in the concentrations. So, in slide number 59, we combine all three of these important test statistics into one decision structure. For example, if your F statistic is below zero, if you have a high confidence factor, 95% or greater, you have a strongly decreasing trend. Conversely, if your F statistic is above zero, if your confidence factor is between 90 and 95%, maybe you have a probably increasing trend. When you have low confidence in your data, when the data don't indicate a trend is there, we still can separate the data into a stable trend, which is a low coefficient of variation, and something called no trend, which indicates a higher coefficient of variation or maybe an increasing S statistic. So this is the way we take three different statistics and slice up our data. I frequently say data are like a big block of tofu. Sometimes you need to slice it up into small pieces in order to swallow the whole thing. Traditionally, vegetarians get annoyed at that comment, so I apologize. Slide number 60. Once you get your summary statistics and your trends together, you can visualize those on a map, and this is where having a good spatial database is important. In slide number 60, there's an example in map A of the concentrations normalized by the screening level for individual locations. You can see green triangles represent concentrations below the screening limit. Yellow, orange, red represent concentrations above the screening limit. In map B, you see the trend for each of these sites. Red dots indicate increasing trends for the same well locations, and green dots decreasing trends, blue dots non-detect. So if you look over on one side and you see you're below a screening level, but you look on the right side and see that you have an increasing trend, that may be something that you want to, a well you want to keep an eye on. On the other hand, if you look and you see you have a high concentration with a stable trend or a decreasing trend, you may want to cut back on the monitoring because really nothing interesting or threatening is going on there. So this is an easy way for all the stakeholders to look at the data side by side and understand what's happening at the site. In slide number 61, I talk about another type of hypothesis testing where we can look at whether or not a location is statistically and confidently below the screening level. In the MARA software, we use a statistical approach described in the 1992 statistical analysis of groundwater. produced by the EPA. And though the EPA has not come out with a global statistical guidance since 1992, it's in the works, but that's what we have to rely on right now. In any case, when you're looking at whether or not you have enough data at one location to confidently demonstrate that you're below the screening levels, you can look at things like the false positive rate, the number of samples that you've taken at the site, the critical effect size, which in our case would be the detection limit, and the variability in the data. If you have a low enough detection limit, if you have a sufficient number of samples, and if you have low variability in the data, you can do a hypothesis test to prove that you are statistically below the screening level. And if you are statistically below your screening or cleanup level, then you can turn off the well or step away from the plume. You've moved towards site closure in a very strong way. Slide number 62, we discuss spatial analysis techniques. There are a series of spatial analysis techniques that you can apply depending on the complexity and the budget for your site. Mesh creation is very common. In MAROS, we use a Delaunay triangulation, Delaunay-Tyson-Barnard diagram, and we use this mesh creation to evaluate uncertainty between points and to look at the moments, which I'll talk about in a minute. Do a statistical surface creation, which is a stepwise regression with linear estimators, and create a base map based on this regression through the temporal data. You can use geostatistics or kriging. Groundwater modeling you can use to identify your spatial distributions and perhaps your uncertainty, and then some mathematical optimization techniques. In slide 63, I talk about the spatial analysis in MAROS. MAROS has two different levels of spatial analysis. The first is a plume-wide analysis called moment analysis. And in this, we estimate the total dissolved mass, the center of mass, and the distribution of mass over time. This is built on top of a Delaunay triangulation method. In slide number 64, we look at the total dissolved mass in the plume, the center of mass, and the distribution of mass over time, and then we evaluate the trend, the Mann-Kendall trend. So if you have an estimate of the total dissolved mass for a series of years or a series of different sampling events, you can tell if it's increasing over time, decreasing over time, or stable over time. This is also true for the spread of the mass and the center of mass. One of the things that this type of analysis can do is give you some data to support your plume stability determination. A lot of state laws are written, you know, when you have a stable plume, then you can cut back on your monitoring network. So in order to demonstrate plume stability, you can look at plume delineation, the length of the plume. A lot of times this doesn't change a lot over time. You can look at the individual trend analyses within the plume. The well concentrations. If you have decreasing trends or stable trends, this supports plume stability. If you look at the total dissolved mass over time, if you have a decreasing mass, you can demonstrate that your remedy is functioning, you're meeting remedial objectives, and that total mass is decreasing over time. Where is the center of mass over time? Is it farther from the source? Does that indicate that the source area is decreasing? Is it closer to the source? Does that mean you have more degradation or more remedial efficacy in the tail? And then looking at the spread of mass over time. Is there more mass in the center relative to the edges? All of these things can be added up together to make a demonstration of plume stability. In slide number 66, measuring information loss is an extremely important part of LTMO. In MAROS, we use a slope factor, which determines whether or not you can evaluate the concentration at one location based on the concentrations of the neighboring locations. It's the nearest neighbor approach. If the slope factor is high, then the well is important, and you can keep it in the network. As the slope factor approaches zero, that means it's less important, and you may want to remove it. There are two other metrics in MAROS that help you determine information loss. If we look at the concentration ratio. If the concentration in the plume changes dramatically when we remove a well, we may want to keep it in the program. Also, the area ratio. If the area that we estimate for the plume changes when we remove a location, for example, if we remove an outer or a hull well location, we may want to keep that in the plume and concentrate on eliminating wells that don't really change our concentration estimate and our area estimate. Anyway, well sufficiency and redundancy. If you have high estimation errors, you want to add a location where you have high uncertainty or high estimation areas. If you have low estimation areas, you want to remove wells from those locations. And there are a number of ways to evaluate this using a number of different software programs. But it's basically an information loss estimator. Slide number 68. GTS is a software produced in cooperation with Air Force Center for Environmental Excellence. It's a for environmental engineering now. Sorry about that. It's a software designed to do spatial analysis to remove redundancy in wells and redundancy in temporal frequency using a variety of statistical techniques. It's more sophisticated and probably more powerful than MAROS. It's available in the public sector. What GPS does, it creates a base map or a surface concentration for each COC, and it iteratively removes the least influential wells and re-estimates the map. GTS uses locally weighted quadratic regression techniques and multiple indicator local regression to develop these base maps. Basically, what it does is it finds the optimal degree of data removal, in this case, the optimal degree of well removal, in order to recreate the base map without loss of information. In slide 69 is an example. The map on the left shows a base map of concentrations for all the wells in a network. And the map on the right shows an optimized map with 38% less wells. And you can see that the basic definition of the hot spots and the high concentration areas has stayed the same. And the delineation has stayed mostly the same with 38% less information. In slide number 70, geostatistics, or kriging, is an increasingly important part of site management. Kriging is an interpolation method that was first developed for mining engineers that estimates a value for a concentration based on the existing data locations and on a stochastic method of spatial dependence. The stochastic method of spatial dependence is the variogram, which is illustrated on the left. And variograms generally indicate the degree of correspondence or the degree of similarity between two points over a certain distance. And there are several softwares out there like Surfer and Esri products that allow you to do kriging. A lot of times they don't give you a lot of access to this spatial dependence model or this variogram. So if you're looking at different softwares to do kriging, it's always good to find one where you have some control over this spatial dependence or variogram, and at least you get to look at it before the model is built. In slide number 71, I introduced the evolving methods, which is true mathematical optimization. Optimization is a field of mathematics that was generated in basically the 1960s and 1970s for computational programming, signal transmission types of science. It's been appropriated by environmental science as well as things like economics and other types of sciences in order to solve problems where you have a number of different aspects that you want to optimize and finding the optimum between a bunch of different competing desires. I'm not going to go into too much mathematical optimization, but basically there are three key terms to mathematical optimization. The first is the objective function, and that's the value you want optimized. Do you want to minimize cost? Do you want to maximize concentration estimates, do you want to minimize error? So you write a mathematical function that says, you know, I want to minimize cost. Decision variables are the parameters that you have control over. Which wells do I sample? How often do I sample them? Constraints are restrictions placed on those parameters. For example, you know, we have to sample this point of exposure well, or we have to sample the well in the this one well in the source area. So you want to put in the things that you can't change. And mathematical optimization is highly computer intensive, so generally you have a computer program that runs through multiple hundreds of thousands of iterations in order to optimize your objective functions and come up with a series of solutions that are exist within your constraints. In slide number 72, the Summit tool, which is in advanced beta stage right now, and it should be available, I think, free to regulators and for a cost to consultants, does exactly this. It does this true mathematical optimization. If you look at the chart on slide 72, you can see the number of wells on the x-axis and the maximum error on the y-axis. And so a number of different solutions to an optimal monitoring network are developed. And let's say you want to minimize the number of wells while minimizing the error. In the Summit tool, you can click on the point that represents that and see a map of the wells, the well network, that satisfies those constraints. So, and you can choose between different well networks that kind of sort of optimize all of the things that you're looking at. So this is a very powerful tool, and it should be available sometime soon. In slide number 73, we're going to discuss temporal analysis, optimization of the sampling frequency. As we stated before, the sampling frequency is based on, to a certain extent, the groundwater flow velocity, but definitely on the rate of concentration change. Sometimes the forces that degrade or dilute constituents kind of are a little different from the groundwater flow velocity. For example, you know, if the export from the source is balanced by degradation processes, then the groundwater flow velocity is not going to make a whole lot of difference in the concentration change over time. For temporal analyses, decision logic methods are very common. You can do iterative thinning methods and combine spatial temporal mathematical optimization. Slide number 74, the Morrow software uses a simple decision map. We map the Mann-Kendall trend for the individual well against the rate of change of the linear regression. And if you have a high rate of change and an increasing or even a decreasing trend, you may want to sample quarterly. On the other hand, if you have a low rate of change and a decreasing trend, you may want to back off and sample annually or biennially. There's a decision logic. Also, you may want to adjust your sampling frequency for locations that have that are well above your screening level versus locations that are below your screening level, or for wells that have a long sampling history versus a short sampling history. In slide number 75, GTS offers something really unique. It's a temporal variogram, and what it does is it looks at the distribution of sampling results in time and determines how different they are, and it plots the difference between the sampling results on the y-axis and the time between the sampling events on the x-axis. And if you look up and see where the curve starts to flatten out and you drop straight down, that's the optimal sampling frequency, that's the optimal time between sampling events. In this case, it's about 125 weeks between sampling events where you start seeing a lot of difference between the samples, the results of the samples you've collected. And this brings up an important point that for most well networks, if you cut back on the sampling frequency, you realize tremendous cost savings while really not infringing on your information very much. So most networks will benefit dramatically from reducing the sampling frequency. And you can reduce the sampling frequency without eliminating any of your spatial information and still get dramatic cost savings. In slide number 75, GPS also uses a method called iterative thinning, where all of the data are plotted and upper and lower confidence limits are generated, and then data are sequentially and iteratively removed in order to get to the point where you can no longer recreate the trend. And at that point, you've realized just how much sampling frequency you can cut back in order to recreate the trend. And this gives you an optimal sampling frequency for individual wells in your network. In slide number 77, there's a combined space-time approach where you look at both spatial and temporal redundancy, and samples are collected when the space-time correlated uncertainty exceeds a preset limit. So when you start getting both uncertainty in space and time, that's when you sample, and it's a little more specialized approach to your evaluation. More on the combined approach in slide number 78. You can use integrated algorithms for determining both spatial and simultaneously determining spatial and temporal optimization. Groundwater transport models can be used, simulation models, data models, signal processing such as Kalman filters, and genetic programming are all part of this mathematical optimization. And the optimal system will estimate the location of the plume at any given time. You may want to move to these more sophisticated combined approaches if, for example, you have an expanding plume and you want to decide where the plume might get to in 10, 15, 20 years using the model. GTS and MAROS generally evaluate the plume within the current monitoring network. So if you want to look outside of the monitoring network, if you're worried about expanding plumes, you might want to look at these combined approaches, which again require more expertise and may be a little bit more expensive, but they can be worth it. Okay, slide number 79. What you end up with at the end of your spatial and your temporal evaluation is a series of evidence. You want to line up these lines of evidence and evaluate the quality of information from each location and how it meets the monitoring goals and objectives. You look at detection frequency trends, plume stability, spatial redundancy and spatial uncertainty, sampling frequency, consistent with the rate of change. And in slide number 80, what you come up with is a series of monitoring locations and frequencies that serve your monitoring objectives and support the decisions that need to be made. You end up with a list of wells that you should remove because they're redundant. Locations where you may add a new well in order to counteract uncertainty, and an optimal sampling frequency. When you get all of these factors in place, all of these recommendations in place, then you do a qualitative review to make sure that you haven't left out any of the things that Dave was talking about in the earlier talk. And at this point, we're ready to take questions.
Okay, this is Kathy Yeager again, and I'll be moderating this question and answer session. I have one question that was submitted by email, and we can take that first, and then we can go to the phone line. And this is from Kevin Deppes in California. While discussing slide 55, you described the use of concentration maps. In particular, mm-hmm. you identified dot maps and bubble plots as being useful for the evaluation. Do you have any recommendations for where one could obtain more information on concentration maps?
Well, GTS does something called the bubble maps. And if you download the GTS software from the Air Force APSI website, you can read that. Otherwise, this concentration maps and dot maps are something that you can do yourself. Just take your concentration, divide it by the regulatory screening level, and then you can have a magnitude of how much each well exceeds the screening level, and then you take that and translate that into a color, like if it's say 100% or twice the screening level, you turn it red. If it's right at the screening level, you turn the dot green. This is where if you tie it into the Esri software, it can be really useful. But that's basically how we do it. If it's three times the regulatory screening level, it's red. If it's two times, it's yellow. If it's right at the screening level, it's light green. And then if it's non-detect, it's blue. So that's how we do it.
Okay, here's another one from John Boyland from the Department of Energy. You mentioned DTS and MAROS and some others. Any thoughts on VSP, which I think is Visual Sampling Plan?
Isn't that for a site that's not fully characterized yet? I'm not familiar with that, so.
Well, this is Dave Becker. I guess, I do know that VSP, Visual Sample Plan, has some things that are applicable to monitoring program optimization, and I know that the folks who have developed VSP are looking for enhancing those kind of capabilities. I haven't used it for that particular purpose, so I really can't speak to it, but I know that it is something that they're looking to make very, very powerful and very useful for these kind of things.
Do you know if that's public domain?
Yeah. VSP is put out by, I believe, Pacific Northwest Labs for Department of Energy. And I think if you do a Google search or another search for VSP, you can find where you can download it. It is public domain.
Okay, well, why don't we go to the phone lines? There are a few of you on the phone, so are there any questions from the phone? Remember to unmute your phone if you do have a question. Okay, I think that might be it for questions right now. What we're going to do is take a 5-minute break. So if you can come back in 5 minutes, which would be, according to my clock, 2:50 Eastern.
Kathy, are you still around?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Did you want me? Is it about time to start?
Yes, it's 2:50 now, and we're on slide 83. And I'll turn it back over to Dave Becker. Just one reminder, if you have questions as we go along, feel free to email them, and we can answer them at the end. I already see there's one more here that we can answer at the end. But, Dave, it's on to you.
Okay, great. Anyway, well, welcome back from the break. I just want to cover some aspects of reviewing the results of a long-term monitoring optimization study, because I realize that a number of people who are on the call may not be necessarily in a position to actually perform the optimization, but may actually receive the optimization either as a regulator or as a client to a consultant who performs it. And it is a good idea to take a look at those results and make sure that the recommendations and the results are consistent with your understanding of the site. So let's move now to slide 84. I just kind of want to point out that the review of an LTMO report really involves some qualitative optimization on your part, because you're always going to kind of be comparing what's recommended to what you think might be necessary. So the LTMO report should be evaluated to make sure that the folks doing the optimization adequately considered the hydrogeology at the site, as we talked about before, that they had a good understanding of the objectives and requirements and constraints for the site, and that they sort of parroted back what they had understood regarding the objectives for the site in the report, so that, you know, it was clear they understood that. And then what I think is an important consideration is that the folks performing the optimization went into it with the open-mindedness necessary to recommend not only perhaps reductions in the program, but enhancements to monitoring program if those were appropriate and necessary. Lastly, I wanted to point out that as a general consideration that the documentation for the optimization needs to be provided, particularly if a quantitative tool was used, the output from those software packages or geostatistical tools were provided with the report. sometimes even perhaps providing the software itself so that you could actually run it if you chose to. Let's move now to slide 85. This is kind of a good opportunity to go over some of the things mentioned a little bit before, sort of in the context of review here. But as I mentioned before, understanding the data history, the quirks in the data is pretty important. And so as a reviewer, particularly if you're knowledgeable about what's been done at the site in the past and the things that have happened with the data, that you want to take a look at the data that were used by the folks who did the LTMO and make sure that they used the right data, that they didn't incorporate data that would be questionable or not comparable, not representative. So you would want to raise a red flag if they did use data that were of poor quality or that were not comparable. And also maybe to raise a red flag if they didn't meet some of the minimum data requirements that Mindy had talked about in terms of the number of sampling rounds used to evaluate trends and perhaps the amount of data necessary to do the geostatistical analysis. Let's move now to slide 86. Again, if you are the person who's very knowledgeable about the site hydrogeology, you're going to want to verify that the optimization adequately considers the complexity of the hydrogeology at the site or lack thereof in coming up with a recommendation. So hopefully there's a description of the conceptual site model in the report to compare to your own and have to verify that folks conducting the optimization considered the things we talked about before. How fast is the contaminant and groundwater likely to travel? What are the impacts of nearby pumping? Did they adequately consider the screen intervals of the different monitoring points such that they understood the three-dimensional nature of the plume? These should be documented in the report. Lastly, you probably want to make sure that any of the assumptions inherent in the quantitative methods used are consistent with the site-specific conditions. Now to slide 87. We've all emphasized the need to understand the monitoring of its objectives. Again, they should restate what they understood the objectives to be for the monitoring program and to make sure that what monitoring network and sample frequency, that what they've recommended would actually allow you to make decisions about meeting those objectives. Will you have a program that would let you assess the migration of the plume or evaluate the remedy performance to identify unexpected occurrences, shifts in the plume, rebound following treatment, the influx of contaminants from another source, for example? And then lastly, would you actually have enough time to respond to an unexpected result, chemical concentration in a well, such that you could implement a contingent remedy? And then certainly, if there were any stakeholder concerns, those kind of non-technical issues, are they reflected in the recommendations? Let's move now to slide 88. Certainly part of the review, if you're a regulator, is to evaluate whether or not the recommended program meets the regulatory requirements. It's generally pretty straightforward. Usually these requirements are spelled out in a permit or some other decision document, perhaps, you just want to make sure that they're meeting whatever minimum requirements there are for locations of the wells, the number of wells, upgradient, downgradient of a site. Spacing on wells perhaps might be a requirement. Are they honoring the designated compliance wells? Are they providing an adequate number of sampling rounds for a decision that may be upcoming? There may even be regulatory requirements for specific analytical parameters to be analyzed for. So you would just go down through those requirements, make sure that those are still met with the recommended program. Going to slide 89, again, I've got a few other sort of a grab bag of considerations here. One is, what about the folks who actually conducted the optimization? Do they have the right skill set to perform the optimization they did? Certainly, it's a little bit of sort of the horses out of the barn by the time you get the report, so this might be something more to consider in discussions before the LTMO, in review of the work plan or whatever. But if you do have reason to doubt the qualifications at the time you get the report, the only thing you can do is look even more closely at the recommendations and methodology and things like that. Another thing, some of the logistics of implementing the recommendations can be a little difficult. For example, the timing of the sampling recommended should consider the weather conditions. As somebody who's periodically done field work, having a monitoring program that requires sampling in January and July, that can be tough on the sampling crew and can really reduce productivity and actually raise costs. So if it's acceptable from a seasonality point of view, if maybe making the sampling events occur during spring and fall, that may be a little bit easier. There may be some constraints in terms of when some wells, particularly residential wells or irrigation or production wells, may be available. You may have to schedule your sampling during the seasons when those pumps are being used or the residents are in their summer homes or whatever. And we may want to, if we have different recommendations for different wells, group the wells that get sampled so that we minimize the number of mobilizations to the site over the course of a year. Lastly, if there's some cost impacts to the recommendations, you might want to verify that the cost impacts are correctly identified and summed. Do the unit costs that they have for the labor, analytical costs, data management, are those realistic based on your past experience? If they're installing new wells or something like that, or recommending them, are the installation costs representative of what you've paid in the past? So moving now to slide 90, let's talk a little bit about, you know, once we've got the recommendation, we've reviewed them, now we want to go forward and implement them. One of the keys is to build a consensus with the stakeholders, and probably the best way to ease the implementation of these recommendations is to involve the stakeholders throughout the monitoring optimization process, including the early planning and some of those qualitative parameter selection process, things like that. The more transparent the process is, generally the more credibility the results have. And so try to keep everything up above board and explain everything and how things will be done. All results need to be presented regardless of the impact to the project. Even if it's not what you expected or not what you wanted, show the good and as well as the bad. That adds credibility, too, with the stakeholders. And then any changes that are recommended to some of the sort of related aspects of the monitoring program, sample methods, and as well as the location and frequency, those need to be discussed, and the discussion should focus on the technical merits and how the changes are really going to support site decision-making. That should be the focus, and that helps build consensus. Let's move now to slide 91. Something that certainly been made apparent to me in some recent monitoring optimization efforts I've been involved with is that the changes are a lot easier to implement when you have decision documents for the site that acknowledge the need for flexibility in these kind of programs. Decision documents that are very explicit about what wells get sampled and when introduce another whole hurdle of trying to change those documents in order to allow the recommended changes in the monitoring program. So the best decision documents are ones that recognize the need for flexibility and changes in the future to the monitoring program and perhaps even outline a process by which periodic monitoring optimization is conducted. This is best done in context of an overall site closure strategy or exit strategy, some people may call it. As sampling optimization can be part of that overall strategy. Certainly any cost impacts have to account for the changes in the decision documents if necessary or the sampling and analysis plan for the site because those kind of things do have to be documented. Another topic that comes up in implementation, particularly if you've decided to exclude wells from the monitoring program, is what to do with them. Before people run right out and decommission them or abandon those wells, grout them up, it's probably best to consider their other uses, too, besides chemical sampling. those wells may still be useful for piezometric water level measurements. And so even if they're not sampled for analytical purposes, if they're still measured for water level purposes, might want to keep those around. We may want to retain wells in case there's changes in the future to a plume, particularly cross gradient wells, if there's some reason to think that the plume may shift laterally over time. If the plume is truly remediating and shrinking, wells that are distant from the plume, particularly downgrading of the plume, and you've got other clean wells between the plume and those probably could be abandoned and as well as taken out of the sampling program. One of the things that is sometimes good is to retain some of the wells, keep them around, don't sample them, you know, necessarily for a while, but then at some later date, go back and sample them again just to verify that what we expected to happen really did happen. And obviously, if you abandon them, that's something you can't do. The last thing I want to mention about implementation is that monitoring optimization is not a one-time shot. There should be a recognition that things continue to change over time, and that monitoring optimization is probably going to be appropriate in a number of years down the road. So it's a periodic exercise. With that, and slide 92, I'm going to turn it back over to Mindy. I hope Mindy's there.
Sorry. Thanks, Dave. I'm going to discuss one of the case studies we've been working on over the last few years. It's Frontier Hard Chrome site. It's an NPL site in Vancouver, Washington. If you move to slide 93, this is just a recap of some of the goals and objectives for any LTMO analysis. First of all, we want to determine something about plume stability. We want to evaluate concentration trends over time. We want to remove redundant wells without loss of information. We want to add new wells in areas to control uncertainty. And we want to develop sampling frequency recommendations. And finally, a final reality check or qualitative review of what we found. So in slide number 94, here's a summary of the site. Frontier Hard Chrome was a half-acre chrome plating facility active between 1958 and 1983. The facility was in Vancouver, Washington, which is right across the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon. Liquid wastes from the facility were disposed of in a dry well kind of behind the chrome plating tanks and seeped into the groundwater, into the soil. The groundwater is affected, shallow groundwater in the area is affected by hexavalent chromium. There was a downgradient extraction well for industrial purposes, and so the plume spread through this kind of transmissive unit down to this extraction well. The whole area around Frontier Hard Chrome is a former heavily industrialized area. It was an area of shipbuilding during World War II, a very significant port. And the site area is undergoing rapid redevelopment. Like many areas next to oceans and rivers, it's a prime location for residential development. A lot of retirees are relocating to Vancouver because of the really nice weather and the proximity to the city. So there's strong redevelopment pressure in the area. The interesting thing about the site is that the source area was treated by in-situ redox manipulation. It was treated with heavy reductants to reduce chromium-6 to the less toxic and less mobile chromium-3. And perhaps the interesting thing about the site is that the source treatment was extremely effective. And effective source treatment and source removal is almost like a geologist in dress clothes. We all know it's possible, but no one's ever actually seen it. So in this case, the source treatment was extremely effective. On slide 95 is an aerial photo of the current site. The orange triangle is the location of the Frontier Hard Chrome chrome plating facility. If you see in the lower left-hand side, the Columbia River. And the area with lots of geometric vegetation is the former industrial site where that groundwater pumping well was, that's since been redeveloped into very nice condominiums and a river walk and mixed commercial and residential area. The groundwater flow direction is to the south-southeast, and since the industrial pumping well was shut off, it's more of a flat gradient. To the east of the site, groundwater flows to the south-southwest. To the east of the site is a municipal pumping field for municipal water supply. And the area around the Orange Triangle is scheduled for redevelopment as a mixed retail zone. So that's the basics of the site. The geology is about what you'd expect. There's a fill level, about 20 feet fill on the surface, and then an alluvial sediment zone with mixed silt and cobbles and sand. The alluvial unit is separated into an upper alluvial unit and a lower alluvial unit, zone A and zone B, separated by a discontinuous clayey silt between the two. The depth of groundwater goes down to about 100 in the zone B lower unit. Okay, and slide number 96. Remember I said we identify our monitoring objectives. The monitoring objective for this site is to ensure the dilution and dispersion of affected groundwater, basically to make sure that that remedy actually worked. And it's also to support the site redevelopment that's ongoing. Slide number 97 is kind of a poor quality map. I used aerials from the time around when the releases took place. If you look, there's Zone A wells identified on the left-hand map and Zone B wells identified on the right-hand map. The orange rectangle is the area of the original source area, the chrome plating and the dry well. The light yellow blob is an area of in-situ redox treatment that was injected into the subsurface to continue to treat the groundwater. This is an example of a dot map. Each one of the well locations, the average concentration has been normalized by the screening level, the Washington State screening level. And you can see, because of see all the green dots, those are locations that are below the screening level. You can see a few red and orange and yellow dots, which are above the screening level. So in Zone A, there is a few hot spots right next to the source area. But in Zone B, which is a little bit more transmissive, a little bit deeper, we have a distribution of hexavalent chromium down gradient from the source treatment area. So in slide number 98, are the results of the Mann-Kendall trends for all of the wells. There were 16 wells in Zone A, 17 wells in Zone B, and of course, because it's chromium, none of them were non-detect. But if you look over under P, D, and D, probably decreasing and decreasing trends, 31% of Zone 1 wells showed decreasing trends, 41% of Zone B wells showed decreasing trends, and for stable trends, S, 44% of Zone A and 12% of Zone B showed stable trends. So you can see that a third to two-thirds of all of the wells had stable to decreasing trends. There were no increasing concentration trends, and the remainder of the wells had concentration trends that had a high variability in the data, and so those are no trends, but most of those wells show variability between detection and non-detect. So they're getting down very, very low concentrations. So what we have here is a well that is very close to being completely, a plume that is very close to being completely clean. In slide number 99, these are the Zone B wells, and you can see the trends are indicated. Green dots indicate decreasing trends, yellow dots, stable trends, And the kind of brown dots are not no trend. Those are the ones that are going back and forth, have a lot of variability in the data. And the larger map, or the larger view, the center of mass for each sampling event is indicated by a blue circle with a light blue interior. What we saw in zone B was a retreating or decreasing center of mass. That means the center of mass for the whole plume was decreasing back toward the source area, which indicates, you know, a great deal of either degradation or dispersion or in the downgradient area, and general decreasing in the size of the plume. So these things all contribute toward making the general statement that, yes, we can remove wells or decrease monitoring effort because we do have a decreasing or shrinking plume. Slide number 100 is output from the MARIS analysis that gives you an idea of what the uncertainty between the well locations is. Each one, this is like a skeleton map of the plume, and it shows the Delaunay triangulation. Each one of the points is a well, and the triangle created between the points has a letter, an S or an M, in it that indicates the level of uncertainty between the points. S means small uncertainty, M means moderate uncertainty. So if we look at all of the wells in Zone B, we see that we have no areas of large or extremely large uncertainty. So we're not going to recommend any new locations for this plume at this time. If you look at, keep your eye on the locations in the center of the plume. And if you switch to slide 101, you can see the optimized plume. Several locations were removed. And then I went back through and evaluated whether or not this increased the uncertainty between the points. And it did not. You can still see that for the entire plume, we have small to moderate uncertainty between each of the points. So there's really, the wells that we took out were redundant, and no new locations are necessary for this plume. The redundancy analysis suggested keeping all of the outer shell or the delineation wells in order to achieve the monitoring objective of delineating this plume. Okay, in slide 102, one of the interesting things I did here, because the site is scheduled for redevelopment very soon, I got the redevelopment maps from the developer and layered it on top of the information from the MARIS analysis. And you can kind of see that the wells that we have, that we need, are indicated in green. The wells that I recommended to be removed from the network are indicated in gray boxes. Unfortunately, they decided that they needed to put a building on top of the source area and on top of some of the wells that I recommended keeping in the network. In this case, they may want to move the wells somewhat or install some new wells so that they can plug and abandon those locations that we decided that we needed in order to evaluate the continued efficacy of the remedy. One of the things that you might consider when you're doing an LTMO and there's property redevelopment is getting together with the stakeholders on the front end of the process and talking to the developer about locating parking lots and buildings in places where you can still maintain your monitoring network or your remedy while development is ongoing. So the pictures that are to follow are our site visit. If you go to slide 103, by the time we went out to evaluate, do the qualitative evaluation of the network after the recommendations, they were already building the shopping center. And you can see us standing out there looking for our wells. Slide 104, you can see they paved over several locations, but they didn't pave over any of the locations where I said that they could abandon the wells. So it's kind of a Peter principle here. Slide 105, the city decided to move the road in order to serve the shopping center, and again, they paved over some of our delineation wells. So when I made the recommendation that no new wells were needed, it was before we went out to the site and found that we may have to re-drill those wells anyway. So good news, bad news. If you go on to slide 106, there's a summary of the recommendations that I made for the site. When I received the data, they were doing quarterly sampling for 33 locations out there. And again, this was after, 2 years after the source area remedy was installed. That would be a total of 132 samples a year from 33 locations. After the optimization, I recommended removing 10 locations from the networks, resulting in 23 spatial locations, and dropping the sampling frequency back to annual. And this caused a dramatic reduction in the effort and the cost from 132 samples a year to 23 samples a year, largely as a result of reducing the sampling frequency. If you go on to slide 107, remember I talked about doing hypothesis testing to determine if the locations are statistically and confidently below the screening levels. Here we have a summary of two different types of analyses I did for determining if the wells were statistically had attained the cleanup point. If you look at the third column over, this is a sequential t-test for determining if the well is below the MTCA, which was the Washington State regulatory screening level. And you can see that 94% of the wells in the network, the original network, were below the screening level, statistically and confidently, and could probably be removed without any problem. 71% of the wells in Zone B were also statistically below the screening level. This is very strong data for supporting a reduction in monitoring effort. If you can run these statistics and show that you're confidently below your regulatory screening level or your cleanup level, you can remove the wells or dramatically cut back on the sampling. Very powerful tool. Slide 108. So what are the lessons that we learned from doing the Frontier Hard Chrome? Well, one, that source areas could be cleaned up. We have a significant data set now. Also, the importance of vertical project integration, keeping that spatial database and making sure everyone is working off of the same spatial database in the case of property redevelopment. It's important to have a high-quality geographic information system that everybody buys in on with accurate accurate locations. And after that, redeveloping the property and ensuring that you have a proper monitoring network can be accomplished fairly successfully and fairly easily. Okay, now I'm going to talk about some LTMO challenges, and you may have gathered from some of the things I've said, some of the things I'm going to talk about. Moving on to slide 110, there are four basic areas that present challenges. First is the data, the database and data collection. Second is hydrogeology. The hydrology of the site can present significant challenges to instituting most optimization quantitative methods. The cost of the optimization and also stakeholder reluctance. Moving on to slide 111. Data challenges are the biggest and most daunting of all of them. Most of the time, when you ask for a database or you ask for the site data, you end up getting boxes of data or a big FedEx package. That's a depressing day for me, getting a box in the mail. You want your data to be in an electronic database. You don't want multiple files and from multiple consultants, and you want it to be well organized. The data should be well reviewed. Dilution samples should be reviewed, and the one that is most representative should be chosen. If data were collected that are extreme outliers, they should be reviewed. Sometimes when the technician goes out to sample the well, he'll write down well number B. It's actually well number D, and you end up with data that really make very little sense. If you're giving your data to an outside consultant to do the review, it is really hard to remove outliers if you are not intimately familiar with the site and the collection methods. Data gaps. If you get data for some of your constituents and not all of them, if you get data for some years and not all, that can be a big problem when doing the LTMO. Slide number 112. This is a recap of the data pipeline or the data conceptual model. If you have insufficient data or poor site characterization, that can really put a hitch in your giddy up when you're doing the LTMO. If you don't have EDDs or poor laboratory review or poor data that don't meet data quality objectives, that can be a big problem. If you have database errors, such as wrong cast numbers, names, feedback, and it's electric guitar time. Database errors can really slow down your analysis, and every time you add 3 days to a consultant doing an analysis, that doubles the cost because they need one day to just complain about it. If you have insufficient data to do the statistics that you need in order to demonstrate that your site is achieving your remedy goals or your site is achieving your moving towards closure, that can be a real problem. A lot of times site managers will try to save money by taking fewer samples on the front end of your data characterization, but then when you come to the point where you have to write a report and you have to do the statistics to make a demonstration, and you have insufficient statistics, then you have to go back and collect more data. Every time you slow down on this progress toward closure, it costs you money. So taking the right samples at the right time is extremely important. The last part of the data pipeline that can go wrong is bad relationships with stakeholders. I've sat in on calls where, you know, the state didn't trust the EPA, and the EPA didn't trust the PRPs, and the PRPs didn't trust each other, and this is often a result of poor data maintenance and poor site characterization, and it just slows everything down and makes everything very, very difficult. Slide number 113. So the top challenges that I list for poor data maintenance are disorganized information contained in many reports, lots of PDFs, not in a centralized database, missing data, lack of detection limits, database errors like wrong cast numbers, multiple names for the same well, multiple COC names, filtered samples are not distinguished from unfiltered samples, data are not well reviewed, the dilution, several dilutions are in the database, you don't know which one to choose as the accurate one, laboratory artifacts are not identified, the flags aren't included in the database. Slide 114. Lack of vertical integration of the information. The person who's making the decisions about the project doesn't have the same information as the person who's driving the bulldozer, or who doesn't have the same information as your database manager. Managers don't supervise the data. Lack of statistically significant data set, big data gaps, uneven sampling intervals can be a real problem. Lack of location coordinates for the wells. I say, if you have been working on a site for 20 years and you do not have location coordinates for the wells, there's a problem. You can get a team out with a GPS unit and get those data relatively easily, and the time is now. Lack of GIS files or consultants who won't share GIS files, that can be a problem. But the main problem I run into is lack of stated monitoring objectives. A lack of an overall idea of why we're going out there and collecting data in the first place. And no decision points identified. You know, what are we going to do if there's a 50% increase in the concentration? You know, that action is not identified. Slide number 115. Hydrogeology can be a big problem, as all of you know. Seasonality, if there's a fluctuating groundwater levels, if there's agricultural pumping, flooding and drought. Variable groundwater flow directions. If the groundwater flows west in the spring and it starts flowing south in the fall, that can really bring complications in designing a monitoring network. Catastrophic events such as flooding, hurricane, droughts, again, that's on the top of my mind. I'm looking forward to some very fun data coming in over the next few years from our recent catastrophic events down in the Houston area. karst and fracture formations, channelized flow, can be a real challenge if you don't have a good enough site characterization to be able to predict where these anomalous flow events are. Also for karst and fracture geology, some of the spatial statistics are not going to be applicable. If you have two wells that are very, very close to each other, and one of them has, you know, is screaming hot, and the other one is non-detect, while you have a well much farther away that's very similar to the one on the fracture flow, that can really mess with your geostatistics, because the distribution is not spatially correlated in a way that the software understands. So that can be a real challenge. Also, if your plume is not delineated, that can cause problems. You may have to go to a more sophisticated type of LTMO analysis that involves simulation or flow modeling in order to be able to determine, you know, where your plume might end and where it may be in another 10 years. Slide number 116. So the questions you want to ask about your hydrogeology and your spatial information before you do the spatial statistics is, do you have sufficient spatial information to be able to characterize the subsurface with high confidence? Is your spatial database sufficient? How well do spatial statistics really apply to your site? I mean, do you have a lot of fracture flow and karst? And do the data support the site conceptual model? There's nothing like an LTMO to be able to tell a story that should line up really well with your site conceptual model. Slide number 117, the budget question. There are some aspects of LTMO that you may not account for in terms of how much it's going to cost. You have the cost to construct, expand, or rehabilitate your electronic database. That can be significant. So if you're thinking about whether or not LTMO is right for you at this time, think about how much you have to invest in the database. You have to include the cost to perform the analysis. You have to include the contingency that you may have to install new sampling locations. Ultimately, this is going to benefit you because you're going to have better information, and the better your information, the more likely you are to proceed to closure rapidly and easily. But it may be a short-term increase in the cost. You have to include the cost of the decision document, and the cost of modifying your procedures and your standard operating protocols. Those documents can be a little more expensive. You may have to modify a permit or modify a rod or modify an institutional control. I know that EPA people are really reluctant to modify rods. That must be a lot of work. Also, one of the main hindrances to instituting an optimized network is modifying your contracts with your laboratories and with your contractors. The people who sample the wells and the people who do the analysis don't necessarily want to cut back on your monitoring effort because it means less money for them. So there can be considerable reluctance among your contractors and your laboratories for this optimization of your network. Slide number 118. In terms of stakeholders, what are the main hindrances to implementing an LTMO? First of all, lack of consensus on characterization. If your state regulator doesn't think you've delineated the plume, and you have, I mean, that can be a problem. Consensus on the remedy. Have you all agreed on what the remedy is and how it should be functioning? If you have multiple consultants or multiple potentially responsible parties on a site, if there's ongoing litigation, that can be a real hindrance to developing efficient monitoring networks and efficient remedial systems. If there's resistance to implementation from the laboratories, like I said, or from the contractors or the consultants, that can be a problem. Slide 119. Are you undergoing a remedy optimization? Has the system been shut down recently, and is that going to cause some changes in the plume, and are people uncertain about that? Usually, if you have a pump and treat system or a natural attenuation remedy, that are ongoing, it's not a problem. But if you're going to change the pumping rate, or if something about the redox conditions changed in the subsurface, you may have some stakeholders that want to do something different. Also, property redevelopment can cause some issues with instituting an LTMO. Are you going to change owners soon? Is it going to change status at some point? So you need to know that. Okay, slide 120. To summarize, LTMO relies on the sum of all aspects of the project that have gone on previously, from the raw data to the development of the site conceptual model, the policy and the regulatory status of the site, the regulatory decisions that have already been made that you can't really get out of, and the relationships between the stakeholders. LTMO, really, you have to step back and review every aspect of what's gone on before in order to come up with the most efficient and most sustainable monitoring network to support your progress towards site closure. And at that, I think we're going to take some questions.
Yes, this is Kathy again, and I know that we're short on time, so we'll try to answer the questions quickly. We have five questions that were emailed, and I'll start with those. The first one is from John Boylan from the Department of Energy. He had a question about the training I mentioned that's planned for Denver this winter. More information on that. Yes, we will be announcing the training on TechDirect. And if you're not a subscriber to TechDirect, you can go to cluin.org/TechDirect, and you can sign up to be a subscriber to that email system where the first of each month you'll get an email regarding new documents, training courses, etc. But you probably already are linked into that if you got onto this training. And the next one is from Emily Daniels in Michigan. Is there a template available for a typical LTMO? For example, pieces to include, supporting documentation, et cetera? This is a good question. Mindy or Dave?
We have LTMO reports on the website, the Frontier Hard Chrome, the Taylor Road, the Clear Water Supply. Kathy, do you remember all the LTMO reports we have?
Yeah, we have 10 to 15 case study reports posted at cluin.org/optimization, and there are more on the FRTR.gov website, but we don't have a template that she's asking about.
The roadmap to long-term monitoring optimization is a discussion of things that may go into an optimization, but it's not a template.
Right. But that may be something that could be useful to do in the future. Okay, this is from Jane Dolan from EPA Boston. The fifth step in the roadmap is to choose the LTMO method. The methods are subsequently described, but it's not clear how one decides which tool to use.
Well, you have to look at it's not clear. You have to look at the complexity of the site. For example, if you have a relatively small site, you have a well-understood hydrogeology, a well-understood source area, you may be able to just do simple statistics. And if you have good stakeholder relations, you present the simple statistics and everyone can agree. Really, we only need to monitor four wells at this site. It's just a gas station. On the other hand, if you have a plume that's not delineated, if you have a plume that may be moving into another groundwater unit, like dropping down, and you need a good three-dimensional rendering, you may need to pursue more advanced mathematical modeling and groundwater modeling options. Again, it depends on the size, the complexity, the potential receptors. I can't come up with a rule of thumb, but that's the closest thing I have to it.
And it is elaborated on more in the document, I think, than what we talked about today. Okay, the next one is from... Go ahead, Dave.
No, that's right. Very briefly, didn't we have a link somewhere for one of the handouts we did in the live training, the in-person training, that compares the different optimization tools that might help people kind of identify the requirements and level of complexity, things like that?
Yes, we do. We have a table that outlines each method and then various characteristics about each of those methods. And I thought that was in the roadmap, too. Is it not, Dave?
I think you're right. Yes, it is. Yes.
Yeah, but that is a good reference. Okay, this is from Walter Wenig from Denver, Colorado. Roughly speaking, how long does it take to go through the optimization process?
Again, it depends on the size of the site and the quality of your database. If you have a very high-quality database, I can do an optimization in 3 or 4 days. It takes me longer to write the report, but, you know, I can get the results in 3 or 4 days. If I have to construct a database, if I have to go back through old reports, you're going to have to give me a month or two, and I'll have a bad attitude.
Yeah, I certainly, in my opinion, the easier it is to mine the information out of a database, the faster you can do it. And I would agree with Mindy, if you've got a very good database, you can do it in short order. Otherwise, it can take a while.
Yeah. If you have 400 wells and 3 groundwater units, that's going to take a few weeks to get the results, and then a few more weeks to write the report, and then a series of months before all of those stakeholders read it and actually approve it. So,
sorry to interrupt, Mindy, but to get to that point where you're ready to do the evaluation, moving forward from that point is one thing, but having the stakeholder meetings and visiting the site, et cetera, that process, that ramp-up process takes some time as well.
Right.
You have to read some of the reports, you know, and get familiar, you know, with all the background for the site, the objectives, the conceptual site model, you know, the constraints, those kind of things. That takes some time, too.
Right. If there is one report that lists your monitoring objectives, the site conceptual model in detail, and the history of the site, then that makes it a lot easier. But a lot of times we have to read, you know, 4 or 5 different reports to piece together what all that is. And also if the database, if the spatial database is not there, you know, if we don't have a good idea of what the property boundaries are, where the location, the well locations are, where the remedy is, then, you know, again, it's more time.
We still have 2 more email questions, but I don't want to neglect the phone people, so let me open it up if there are any questions over the phone. I guess not. So these are the 2 last questions. What was the cost-benefit ratio for the Frontier LTMO evaluation? How long to recoup cost spent on the evaluation?
That's a good question. I haven't done that. I think the evaluation cost about $15,000. It's a fund lead site, so the taxpayer is picking up the tab. So if we removed, we removed 10 locations and dropped down, I'd say that's a couple of years before, depending on what the cost of sampling, I don't know what the cost of sampling is, and I don't know what the cost of data management is at that site. So.
Yeah, we didn't get into the cost as much on that site.
I guess if you, said $700 per sample and cut back 100 samples. Yeah, I'd say within 1 year you'd probably recoup the cost to do the analysis.
My guess is that you probably get it back in less than a year.
Okay.
But
okay.
You've cut it back quite a ways.
Of course, that doesn't include the re-drilling the wells.
This is from Alan Kane from Conshohocken, PA. When you reduced the sampling program at the hard chrome site from quarterly to annual, did you perform a quantitative analysis to support that recommendation?
There was a decision logic analysis, rate of concentration change versus trend, and Overall, there was a very low rate of concentration change, even though the groundwater flow is fairly rapid in that area because it's a fairly transmissive zone. The concentrations were very low, and they didn't change over time, so it was very easy to back it off. And, in fact, if you redid the analysis after a few more years, you would probably be able to back off your monitoring frequency to once every 5 years without losing any definition in the trend.
Okay, one more question. This is from Katrina Higgins Coltrane from Dallas, Texas. How can we tap into the expertise of the instructors to assist us on fund lead projects that are currently in O&M under the state? Katrina, you can work through your EPA regional office. You actually might be with EPA, and contact me, and we can coordinate how we can get you the support or how we can work with your contractors, et cetera. But you could send me an email or call me. And, again, this is Kathy Yeager, and my contact information is on the main page for the seminar. Okay, that's it. No more questions. I want to thank everyone for participating today and for staying on a little bit longer. I think that's one thing that we'll have to work on. And if you have a moment, please fill out the feedback form so that we can get your suggestions on how to improve the seminar. Thanks again, and have a good afternoon.